All right. I think I'd like to start the show with just a bit of an announcement and honestly, kind of an apology. We've said a lot of things about Boeing over the years, and I would just like to retract all previous statements I've made about Boeing on this podcast. That this is Brian, by the way. Brian would like to retract any negative thing he's said about Boeing. Whoever wrote that article about Boeing on our website, I'm sure would also like to retract any comments made in that article.
Yeah, this is Greg, G-R-E-G. I would also like to add my byline to that retraction, official mechanical freak retraction. Let's just wipe the slate clean. Let's assume anything I've personally said in the past about Boeing, I no longer endorse. You know, it's a cautionary tale about the age of confused epistemology and truth on the internet. And, you know, I think what we've learned here is to rely on more serious legacy media sources. So from this point forward, we're getting all our information on Boeing from Pulitzer Prize winner Dominic Gates, and that's it.
I would also like, I mean, this is apropos of nothing. I would also like to note that both me and Greg, this is Brian, by the way, both me and Greg have gone to the doctor recently and gotten a clean bill of health. And we have no plans on eating any exotic sushi in the future, including...
Sushi's out for me.
Yeah, including pufferfish or blowfish or whatever. We're not interested in having any of that in the future. Just a note for, I mean, our audience, whoever's interested. If somebody just wants to take that down or something, that would be great. Welcome back to the Mechanical Freak Podcast, coming to you live from my new apartment overlooking my beautiful deck and pool. Greg, what's it like seeing how the other half lives?
I feel my feet feel so steady on the ground, and I don't like it.
Greg's currently staring out with lust at the retention pond next to my apartment that's visible from my window, just thinking, is there some way I could like just sit on a piece of wood in that pond, you know, just get the rocking going?
Yeah. Can I just sort of like, you know, heave my upper body up onto a pallet like and float? that's enough for me.
Yeah, I guess we'd like to start the show by just congratulating Boeing on its wonderful streak of good luck. You know, a lot of things seem like they could not be going Boeing's way. And then, you know, Lady Luck has stepped in and, hey, everything's better now. So just once again, I just want to say, you know, we're pro Boeing over here. We don't think they've ever done anything wrong.
Look, Brian, the masters of industry, they make their own luck. Okay.
Well, from one lucky company to another, Greg, I was reading Business Insider the other day because, you know, I like to be an insider when it comes to business. And I'm not going to lie, what actually captured my eye was they're talking about Red Lobster and they were talking about Shrimp Fest, baby. And I kind of thought...
Your favorite.
Yeah, I kind of thought they'd stop doing that. There was a time in my early 20s where kind of essentially as like a gag or a goof, me and friends would go hit up Shrimp Fest and then make ourselves sick on Red Lobster shrimp, on just pounds and pounds of Red Lobster shrimp, kind of as a bit, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. You played a lot of jokes on yourself over the years, haven't you, Brian?
For sure. I gotta say, I had some friends in high school that we used to call ourselves the Buffet Kings, and we prided ourselves on getting kicked out of multiple buffets in the San Antonio
kicked
area.
Out?
Yeah.
How do you get kicked out of a buffet?
A mixture of eating too much and being obnoxious.
Yeah.
Being little assholes.
You and your friends, like, you know, making exaggeratedly large plates and like strutting past the employees as if you're breaking some rule, like when really that's like the point. Like you're like, look, I'm getting away with this. No, we don't care. But
look,
but now
me.
You're annoying. We have to get rid of you.
I'm eating all the slop. I will say there was a one in San Antonio called Guacamole that was a Mexican / Chinese buffet.
Hell yeah.
And
Wok, W-O-K. Yeah, yeah. Oh my God.
And we used to go there all the time because we thought it was funny. And they did karaoke there too, which was great. But we actually witnessed a wedding inside the buffet restaurant one time, so which is a treat I'll treasure forever. Anyways, Red Lobster, they've fallen on hard times. That's what I've learned. And wouldn't you know it, private equity firms at the center of it. Greg, I just want to read you this part from the kind of middle-ish of the Business Insider article. In 2014, amid flagging sales and pressure from investors, Darden Corp sold Red Lobster for $2.1 billion to Golden Gate Capital, a San Francisco private equity firm. Yeah, first bit of comedy, Red Lobster was worth, in theory, $2.1 billion at one point. Hilarious.
I mean, it's a lot of real estate.
Well, Greg, you're hitting on a point that we're about to get to. So to raise enough cash to make the deal happen, Golden Gate sold off Red Lobster's real estate to another entity, in this case, a company called American Realty Capital, and then immediately leased the restaurants back. The next year, Red Lobster bought back some sites, but many of its restaurants were suddenly strapped with added rent expenditures. So basically, this was the private equity firm's plan. Purchase Red Lobster because it's sitting on a bunch of valuable real estate in various American suburbs, right? Immediately sell all that real estate away and to another private equity firm. And then I guess because you still have the restaurant and I guess there's still things to be like milked out of it, go ahead and just rent that land back at a higher price than you would have paid just owning it. Brilliant. This is the brilliant strategies brought to us by America's business colleges.
I know you love these stories of private equity, like, you know, squeezing the last drop of blood out of the organs of American retail capital. But like, if ever there was a turnip, you know, just like, it's Red Lobster. I think these stories are more effective at making your point when it's some like going concern, like someone cares about. Like this Red Lobster is a relic of the past that, like, if it didn't go this way, it would go some other way.
Greg, where are America's 23-year-olds fresh out of college, finally have an income? Where are they going to go to eat 4 pounds of shrimp, get sick, and then call in to work the next day?
Well, that's the thing is, like, you know, I think famously why like the Red Lobster doesn't work anymore is because like food's just too expensive and real estate's just too expensive in this country. So you can't do the all you can eat seafood buffet, you know, like it doesn't work anymore. So unfortunately they can't. The answer is they can't. Yes. Okay. We used to be a proper country. You know, you used to be able to puke up 3 pounds of shrimp in a like parking lot of a shopping mall, but you know,
yeah,
that's neoliberalism, Brian.
I will say that one of my most cherished memories, even as an idiot, you know, like 23-year-old or whatever, one of my most cherished memories about Red Lobster was knowing full well with all the people in my party that the food was bad. Just like eating it and being like, this is not like what shrimp should taste like. This is not what good shrimp should taste like. But just doing it to do it, which really was the American way.
You know? Yeah, that's how I was raised.
Yeah.
Like, bring on the slop and more of it. As an food as an event.
Yeah, what's the say? Like, such terrible slop and such small portions.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah. That's a quintessential like American joke because like, we are as long, you know, yeah, that's what we want. We want the portions to be larger. You know, that's how I was raised. I mean, I was raised like with like buffet mindset, you know, yeah. Like for sure. Like
for some reason, I mean, this is kind of crazy given like lobster's place in like the kind of class hierarchy of American meals. But for some reason in my mind as a kid, I always kind of knew Red Lobster was trash. And the real one that was like, we're living the high life that my parents would take me to occasionally was the Olive Garden, always next to the Red Lobster, all-you-can-eat pasta bowl or whatever, yeah. Which is somehow even trashier than the all-you-can-eat shrimp. But I, you know, as a kid, I'm like, eating the fettuccine just covered in just pure heavy cream and just being like, this is how a king would live.
Heavy cream, man. That's generous of you. That's like some kind of food starch product and water, you know?
Well, on to local news. So we saw this tweet the other day. I'm just going to read it out. City Attorney Ann Davison said via email that King County jail limits are impacting public safety and that it's time to, quote, explore all options to restore jail capacity for misdemeanor crime in response to whether the city is considering contracting with Score Jail. So the basic premise here is, it'd be crazy if somebody called this, this new idea that we're going to have an intense focus on putting people committing misdemeanor crime in jail, including low-level drug possession and things like that. The rock it was running up against was the fact that, contrary to popular belief, jail full.
Yeah.
Like, no more space at the jail, which is why the previous prosecutor wasn't prosecuting a lot of that stuff, because there was literally nowhere to go with it.
And we, you know, when they were arguing about the new, like, Seattle drug criminalization, this is exactly what we said, that yes, this is very stupid. It is like them, you know, funding the cops, you know, to the tune of, you know, more than half the city budget, that's going to just like blow a hole in the budget for years to come. Yeah, it is like a dereliction of, you know, basic administrative responsibility here. But like, and we said as much at the time that the council was being like told, like, you can't buy, you know, people in the county and the city by attorneys, like, this isn't going to work. The courts and the jail can't handle it. And what we said at the time was that on some level they know this, and this is part of the point. The point is to drive home that contradiction. Okay, we're saying our position is, oh, we just need to put these people in jail to solve these problems, and we're going to do what we need to do that and hit that wall. And the answer then is going to be, great, then we need more jail space. And that's what we're finding is, that's what they're saying. So this, you know, this has been floated in council. She's responding to that, to like Sarah Nelson and whoever else, like saying like, yeah, we should look into dropping our contract with King County Jail and let, you know, that'll free up some jail space for King County to keep arresting people on misdemeanors. And the city can contract with a private prison company and thus, you know, have both entities can have plenty of space to throw people in jail for bullshit without trial. Everything that expansion of prisons has done in America, which is increase the number of people and the amount of time people are spending on pretrial detention, against any, imagined semblance of civil rights we have in this country, innocence until proof of guilt or whatever. And just allow you to then also, yeah, just sentence people longer, sentence more people, charge more people. And there, then, you know, ultimately doing the administratively stupid thing that's also the, like, evil, sick, you know, fascistic thing of just punishing poor people as a way of dealing with social problems is also smart politics. Right? Because they'll probably end up getting their way eventually, right? I mean,
I do think there's actually a break on this. And this is, we talked about this when we talked about their, you know, trying to pass the new drug criminalization law. But the difference between now and the 90s, right? So, like, you know, our last big tough on crime panic was the 90s. And the United States famously, like, just went on a jail building spree, right? Yeah. At every level of government, local, state, federal, just were building prisons everywhere. And the reason that worked is because they were taking advantage of the, like, gutting of rural communities by neoliberalism, right? You know, factories leaving and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Essentially gutting exurbs, gutting, you know, rural towns and stuff like that. People were leaving these places, going to the city. And so there was this cheap real estate available, as well as a demoralized workforce willing to do what is a pretty shitty job, which is to be a prison guard.
I mean, screws.
Yeah, like whatever you want to think about prison guards, like the job does suck. Like in, you know, but there was this cheap workforce to exploit and all this kind of stuff. So like the pieces kind of lined up.
And in a way that was like as redevelopment too.
Yeah.
So you can sell it politically like, hey, this is federal and state funding we're bringing to this community to be the economic underpinning of that community, to bring jobs. And there's, so there's towns all across America that are basically just like staffing a prison.
Well, a lot of that stuff got really perverse too, and that small towns would compete with each other to get the prison, right? Oh, yeah. Just like the Miss Amazon contest, was that like 6 or 7 years ago? There's like towns debasing themselves to get a fucking prison for their like locals to both work in and ultimately end up in, you know, like half the town's in it, the other half is policing them.
Well, that's the choice, right? It's like work at the prison or be in it.
And I think that
or live there.
The problem or the contradiction here with the new tough on crime panic, you know, I think the position of both political parties at this point is like 2 million more, right? You know, like let's get that jail population up to 5 million now, right? And the problem is that the real estate market is just fundamentally different, right? And I don't mean that just at the city level. Like, obviously, there's no way in hell any real estate developer or the, you know, chamber is going to allow the city of Seattle to build a new jail within the real estate market of Seattle. Like, the real estate is just too valuable. But at the same time, I was just in Moses Lake the other weekend. They're also having their own real estate crunch. So even these like small Eastern Washington towns, they're having like a real estate speculation bubble as well. You know, I mean, it doesn't look anything like Seattle's, but compared to what their life has been in Moses Lake, like prices have gone through the fucking roof. And again, I think it'll be a hard sell in that market to convince real estate developers to turn over huge chunks of real estate to a prison, right?
I don't know. I'm skeptical of that. I think, look, there's all kinds of ways the state could step in and solve our housing crisis. And I think any and more of those ways can be, you know, brought to bear on this problem. Okay. Like real estate, like, first of all, like you're talking about essentially an infrastructure project. Like it can go anywhere. It can be anywhere on some level. Then, and people will come, like, all you got to do is build a highway. If the prison guards have to commute for 3 fucking hours into what was like state park land, you know,
they're going to convert the Hanford Superfund site into the super jail site. But yeah,
you can develop, like, you know, that's what the state can come in and do. The state can make a whole new settlement somewhere where there isn't a fucking, I mean, like, I think they'll find a way. And I think if you go out into these, like, you're talking about places like in Moses Lake, well, like a lot of that, you know, yeah, there's real estate that is like zoned for commercial and residential use and industrial use that is where the market is what it is. But there's also a shitload that's zoned for fucking farming, you know, that is not part of that market that I think, you know, right there is a way something can happen. A few acres of farmland gets turned into a prison.
They are, I mean, this is the kind of craziness out there. They are converting farmland into subdivisions out there. So I think that does put substantial pressure. I think this is why various states and cities, with Seattle, of course, leading the way, as it always does, have moved towards the idea of island concentration camps.
Yeah.
So, like, Seattle, viewing this problem, was like, hey, we used to have an island prison that's essentially just worthless land. Like, nobody wants it, you know, you can't really do anything with it. What if we just turned it into a concentration camp? And its position and everything like that means that you're now absolved from any concerns, you know, what minimal concerns there are about things like overcrowding and stuff like that. And their fantasies about it, too. I mean, it was like almost true concentration camp in the American sense style, like of a reservation for America's poor, in the sense that kind of like Gaza, you would just shove them all in and then like build a wall around it and just watch the wall and like let them just do whatever on the inside. In Florida, I think there was a spot off of Miami where they're also discussing this idea of island concentration camps. And I think it's one of those things that when you look at kind of the pressures to remove the homeless, right, the fact that they are continually creating new homeless and the real estate pressures regarding prisons, I mean, I you don't just go from like zero to concentration camp. There's like a lot of steps in between, but I think we're doing those steps, you know.
Yeah.
We're walking ourselves down the path, right? And you know, feels good, man. Feels good. Well, speaking of other feel good news, Greg, I don't know if you've seen, but there's some craziness happening on college campuses these days.
Those wild, wacky kids.
Look, the woke are they're running wild out there. And luckily, our intrepid politicians and media have been getting to the bottom of what's behind all of this, right? So, you know, I've been watching all the local news and national news. And so I know that there is some sort of riot happening at college campuses across America. It's unclear why or what the students want. I think it might have something to do with blue hair dye. But luckily, we have politicians and stuff stepping in. Nancy Pelosi, in a televised interview this week, let us know that this has a real Russian tinge to it. It was like Russian involvement here. So that's something to keep out for. So look out for any Ivans or Vladimirs on your local Ivy League campus.
I mean, what's funny is, I mean, like, to give that any credence is sort of ridiculous. But like, if you even try to like work out in her mind, like what the fuck she could be talking about, all you got to do is remember that, right, these people believe that the Russians like helped Donald Trump win the election with like a few hundred shitty Facebook posts.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So I guess in her mind, what she's saying is there are Russian like intelligence bots making pro-Palestine posts and like encouraging like students to get out and protest, which I mean, like, yeah, you know, I think it has more of an Israeli tinge to it. I think it's more Israeli posts that are getting people out on campus. Right?
Yeah, and I mean, on the Russian thing, the Democratic Party specifically, but I think it was Nancy Pelosi actually specifically during 2020 did the same gambit, saying that like the BLM protests were, you know, Russian was like a Russian op, which. It's kind of funny because it was a real Cold War throwback in that it was the official position of the United States for many decades, actually,
yeah,
that the civil rights movement was a Soviet op, because obviously American black people would never be upset with their situation under Jim Crow or under the, you know, soft hand of American liberalism or the soft boot of American liberalism across the North. They had nothing. Basically, the American position was the black people in America have nothing to complain about. So if they're out in the streets, that must be an op. That was the Democrats' position in 2020 as well.
During the Trump presidency, civil unrest in America during the Trump presidency, they're like, yeah, the Russians are, I guess her case is the Russians are trying to undermine Trump now.
The schizophrenia of it is interesting. So we're back to the Russians with Nancy. And I, you know, maybe because I'm almost positive it was Nancy in 2020 who said that as well about BLM. And maybe it's because, like most of the leadership of the Democratic Party, she's approximately 500 years old. So, you know, she's remembering the crystal clear memories she has from 1940. But, you know.
She remembers reading about the murder Romanovs in the newspaper the week it happened, you know?
When she says Russians, she actually means Rasputin.
Yeah.
She's pre-Soviet, actually. She's like, this is that murderous monk. So going to the younger members of the Democratic machine, but still pilled up, Debbie Washing Machine Schultz, she says it's Iran. So the Iranians have reached into American colleges and, you know, got them all worked up about genocide. No other explanation. Now, the House Ways and Means Committee has written a letter to the IRS demanding a full investigation of Chinese financing of the campus protests. So just to keep score here, it's either Russia, Iran, or China. The Wall Street Journal claims it's the Houthis. I like that one. The poorest people,
I mean,
in the Middle East.
You're getting closer. I mean, that, I, that,
if it's a dartboard, we're getting closer.
Well, I mean,
sure.
Like, you know, look, you know, I can see that on some level, right? Like, mm-hmm. as inspiration, like, look at these people, the poorest people in the world. They're going to bat for the Palestinians, right? They're fucking just, they're doing protest in the Red Sea, in, you know, the America, the world's most important shipping lanes through the Suez Canal. Like, they're doing, they're putting their lives, their whole society on the line. They're taking bombs for the Palestinian people. And, you know, that's, yeah. And then they're posting about it like fucking legends too.
Yeah. Oh, hey, that takes us back to 2016 and the Russians. They're posting, guys.
Yeah.
They're posting.
Well, that's what all this is. That's what all this is, right? Okay. I guess they're talking about like Chinese financing of it as well. Like that's more substantial than just inspirational posts, but this is from the same people who are like saying like the Chinese are, you know, taking over our children's minds with TikTok. And like, I guess, are they talking about like, did the Chinese give them deals on those tents on wish.com?
I think for the Ways and Means Committee, that's exactly what they're saying. This is beyond TikTok. They say they're like providing direct financial aid, which is hilarious. Like, on the Houthis.
All the Jewish student protesters at Columbia, you know, they came strapped with like Chinese SKSs and shit, you know.
When it's like that Simpsons episode where they're going to have the like the table marker that says like Jewish Voice for Peace, and then they're going to hit the button and it's going to flip and it's just going to say PLA on it, you know. Yeah, and the Wall Street Journal thing about the opinion page about the Houthis, the funny part about that wasn't even that it was that people were protesters were being inspired by the Houthis. It was that the Houthis were directly training operatives to go to like Colombia. And again, the idea of this, the poorest people
what,
in the
in
Middle
drone
East.
Warfare? In like helicopter, naval helicopter piracy? Like, is that what they're getting trained
yeah.
in?
Like, yeah, it's like, first off, I think the Houthis, let's just say, tactical catalog is a slightly different set of pages than the college campus catalog is put up in the United States.
Feels, feels, you know, again, feels like childish entertaining this, but like the kids who took over the building at Columbia were trained to do that at Columbia by Columbia University and all the classes they have in how cool Columbia is for having armed building takeovers in 68. Yeah. You know?
By its literal like advertising department, yeah. You know? And again, I like the idea that the poorest people in the Middle East who are like, are kind of famous for essentially being like, I mean, you know, pardon the disparaging language, but essentially being hillbillies, right? Like that's like the Houthi position even within Yemen.
And the mountain people.
The mountain people, right? Yeah. The idea that, yeah, they're training Columbia grad students right now in how to sit down. I don't think sit down strike is in the Houthi playbook, I gotta say. I think they passed that point a long time ago. Jonathan Schanzer from the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies.
Sounds dark.
He just went ahead and blamed all Muslims. So Big Muslim is promoting this or funding this.
Well, I mean, we're doing Naked Gun, right?
Yeah.
This is our friend here is our interlocutors here are Leslie Nielsen busting in on the meeting of Arafat and Gorbachev.
Yeah, and Gaddafi.
And Gaddafi.
Yeah.
And
God, what a time, you know, for Gaddafi not to still be alive. Like, Hillary Clinton really did fuck us on this one. Like, you know, think of all the blaming we could be doing with Gaddafi around right now.
Think of all the, like, the drops Gaddafi would be making. Like the most absolute lunatic takes that you got to give him credit for being like for keeping, you know, keeping the faith with the Palestinian people. When do we get to rubbing the birthmark off of Gorbachev's forehead? You know, like is that a bullet point here?
Yeah, you rub off the birthmark and it's actually the Columbia logo on there. And we know the deep op that he's been running this whole time.
Oh my God.
So I did see, there was somebody who blamed Qatar, although I couldn't find them again, but there was some politician blaming Qatar. So credit to them for at least thinking outside the box a little.
Well, I mean,
there's blaming Al Jazeera, but like,
media again, it's like posts, right? It's like they're blaming media, like, which I mean, again, like you are hitting closer there, right? There are someone's doing journalism about the mass murder happening, and thus people in America know about it.
What was that?
It's not most, frankly, it's not mostly from Al Jazeera. It's from social media. It's from social media, from just, they've killed most of the journalists in Gaza. So like what's left, most of them weren't for Al Jazeera, but like it's got half of it's the fucking Israelis themselves, man.
Yeah. I mean, they have the real South Africa problem. Like
the real dirt. It's the media, social media posts coming from the Israelis themselves is a substantial part of the insane, like, dirt on this genocide that's coming out. It's from the beginning, the insanely genocidal rhetoric, right, that from Israelis. And most of that, and then a lot of the other data and real, like, dirt on what's going on comes to America and American students through the Israeli press. It comes from Haaretz.
When you're looking at people who are talking about Times of Israel. Yeah, talking about debunking like Israeli lies and stuff, like half the posts are Haaretz articles.
Right.
It's all, like, here's Haaretz saying that this was bullshit. Right.
Yeah, all the real information, like on first of all, like yeah, the public statements of Israeli government and military officials that are talking about the crimes they're doing or about the crimes they want to do, you know, they're saying that shit in Hebrew most of the time, but it's then coming either in English language papers, translated in English language Israeli papers like Haaretz, or it's other papers in Israel and other news organizations in Israel being translated and then posted here. Like that's where most of this is coming from. So, I mean, Al Jazeera, I'm sure, is doing reporting on this. Obviously, lots of other people, a lot of just social media posts, they can get out of Gaza, the Gazans themselves, like regular people. There is some of that. There was more at the beginning. Like they have so little power or connectivity now. Like there's less of that getting out, but it is some. Like that's where most of this is coming from. I mean, obviously this shit's a fucking joke, but.
Yeah. And I mean, we'll come back. I want to come back and talk about this a little bit later, but, speaking of like comments from Israeli politicians, but also from the Israeli media, you know, a lot of the way Americans are getting that is from American Jews who read the Hebrew press,
right?
Who are then amplifying to an English speaking audience, the exclusively English speaking audience, like what's actually being said, right?
Also, just the translate feature on Twitter.
Yeah. Yeah. The translate feature is really
posting.
Elon didn't see that one coming.
Posting. Like they post this shit. Like Israelis, Israeli government, Israeli military, Israeli news organizations, and real like Israeli Hasbara nuts like in Israel and around the world are posting sometimes in English, but often in Hebrew. And like, you can just read that shit.
Yeah.
You know,
well, we'll continue our little tour here. One of these like Substack nerds who does horse race shit. He was able to square the circle and figure out that Trump's actually behind all the protests. I mean, we had to see that coming.
I managed to decipher most of this like on its own terms.
Well, the thing is, the protests are bad and Trump is bad.
Well, and I guess, you know, by doing this during a Democratic president and protesting the actions of a Democratic president, you know, committing this genocide, I guess you are helping Trump. So, you know, qui bono. Which again, you know, if that's the logic, like that people definitely did say that the 2020 protests were the Russians too, which again is where I you know, question the logic of that, right?
During
Trump's presidency.
Another equally big nerd on Substack argued against that, saying, of course, that the Democrats are the ones doing the protests
against
that
one's the even sitting Democratic president.
That one's even funnier because the qui bono on that one is like, okay, this is just whatever. But this is all to get to my favorite one, which is from Lily Tang Williams, who is a New Hampshire House hopeful, right, running for a House seat in New Hampshire. She's found the real cause, the real source of power in the United States.
Oh, hell yeah.
Which is the Communist Party USA. Gus Hall, get off of those campuses, all right? So she's decided CPUSA's the one at fault here. And my favorite part is when you click on her bio on Twitter, right? You go to her profile page. It just says, survivor of Mao's cultural revolution, entrepreneur and professional. And so I got to say...
So she's like a 70-year-old Chinese woman?
In her picture, she looks young, but who knows? But I got to say, not doing a good job advertising against the Cultural Revolution. if she was a survivor, I guess the argument against the Cultural Revolution was too many survivors.
Just didn't go far enough. Yeah.
Classic didn't go far
I
enough.
I mean, have we checked in on the chairman? How is CPUSA, like, are they out at these protests? Is there anything I can give this one? Is there anything?
Are the 100 members nationally of CPUSA? I have not seen any. I'm sure at Columbia in New York, because that's where essentially the only membership of CPUSA is. I'm sure they've been down to the campus. I don't know that they have like a campus presence there. And like I said, I mean, the CPUSA has been so marginalized. Gus Hall was the head of the CPUSA for decades. I'm sure he's dead now. Like, you know, he was the head in like the 80s and 90s. I'm sure he's dead now. Who knows who's the head of it now? It's been so marginalized, like every left group in America. Like, you know, the idea that they're running a nationwide campaign on is just hilarious. And now here's where we get now into the pure speculation. There was an NYU professor who went into the New York, wrote an editorial for the New York Post, where he blamed, well, it's the kids on campus. They're to blame. But what's actually to blame, and this is where professors come in handy, right? They're able to complicate a narrative, you know, get in there.
Problematize this shit.
Let's go. Get to the pieces, right? And what he figured out is the kids, they're not having sex anymore.
How does he know that, Brian? What's his data on that?
I know. There could not, when I saw this headline, and I felt like, you know, of course, people made jokes about this, but I was like, you guys are really leaving this on the table. The most obvious point here is this is a professor complaining, you know, contrary to what he was told when he was a grad student. His grad students and his undergrads are not fucking him. They're refusing to fuck him. And he's basically writing a whole editorial in the New York Post of like, why did I get in this business?
Yeah. Like. Yep. My students must be sexually repressed, frustrated, etc., because I'm not getting sucked off, by my A students.
Yeah, it's basically like all college kids in jail until, you know, an 18-year-old undergrad fucks me. that is the only thing that'll stop the tide of repression.
Has he considered work as a prison guard?
That's dark. Has he considered work as an Israeli prison guard?
Ooh, yeah.
Even more dark.
Yeah, even darker. I would say getting involved in popular radical causes, like probably it probably is a good way to get laid. So I'm not going to like totally discount that no one is getting laid out of participating in this movement. I guess also you can't necessarily discount that college kids are like having less sex, you know, and that probably isn't only taken up by like a consciousness among college students in like over the last decade that it's okay not to fuck your professor. Like that's probably some of it. That's probably part of the dip in like how much sex college kids are having. But you know, maybe not a large part. It's probably mostly just, all the changing sort of circumstances of contemporary life, poverty, the internet, et cetera, et cetera. Like if this was, these kids, they're putting their fucking lives on the line.
Yeah.
Some cop fucking fired his weapon in that building in fucking Columbia, you know?
Well, basically this guy, you know, he took his editorial from like 4 years ago about why he, you know, his complaints with the Me Too movement or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Like just did some erasing and put in this, you know? I will say, just to bring a little levity to this, I'll relate to our listeners a story that I've told you before off mic, which is back during the 2003, during the anti-war movement when I was on campus at Texas Tech. I was like the head of the anti-war group at Texas Tech, and I used to, as you might guess, as a true crank, was very prolific in the creation of literature. And I was friends with some people at the University of Texas San Antonio, and I used to like hand off literature to them so that they wouldn't have to make their own, right? Because they were cool. And I remember,
you were the nerd of the Texas campus anti-war movement doing the homework for the jocks of the Texas campus anti-war movement.
Yes, and this couldn't have been driven home harder than one time I was in San Antonio and we were all hanging out, and one of the guys from UTSA, he was complaining about some comments that they had been getting online about how the only appeal that the anti-war movement at UTSA had was that the guys in it were all hot, and so the girls wanted to go over and like hang out with them because the guys, they didn't actually believe in, you know, the anti-war movement. They just thought the guys were hot, which was like, again, I think that was like Pelosi's argument about, no, that wasn't Pelosi, that was what's her face, but during the Bernie campaign, the 70s feminist who was like in the CIA, but anyways, neither here nor there. But yeah, that they were all hot, and that was how they're being discredited. So he tells me this, and he looks at me, and he's like, but you guys probably get that up there, too. And here I am, just staring at a wide eye, going, yes. Yes, we do. For sure.
All the time.
This is a comment we are always getting frequently. yeah, that was not a problem. That was not commentary that was being had in Lubbock, I will say. But... this brings us to the final one, which is my favorite one. This was posted by two separate people in opinion pieces in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Post. It's George Soros is actually behind the Free Palestine protests. And I think this gets to a point about the bedfellows that people are falling in with here as they go to support this genocide, that they've now worked themselves into an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory about the campus protest, that a Jewish cabal, which is, of course, in the conspirator's mind, what George Soros pretty much always represents, a Jewish financial cabal is promoting these protests to question, I guess, destabilize Israel or whatever for means.
Well, like,
and
at least they're admitting that this movement is largely backed by Jews.
Right? So in that sense, it is more correct than a lot of these ones.
Right? I mean, it's like, because what do they say? Right. I mean, the overarching main narrative here has, these are all funny, but the one that is coming from all corners all the time and probably comes up in every one of these articles, I'm guessing, is that this movement is anti-Semitic.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. So it may be being fostered by all these forces and circumstances or whatever, but what it's bringing out is a dangerous latent anti-Semitism in America's college kids, right?
Yeah.
And here you have, it's a perfect, capitalist imperial anti-Semitic line of confusing horseshit where you're like, the anti-Semitism is being done by the Jewish cabal.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, wait, what? yes, it is actually true that, these protests are, you know, the people doing them are Jews, American Jews are heavily overrepresented. Making the cries of anti-Semitism like all the more ridiculous, but like,
yeah,
I don't know. I guess, you know, this shit doesn't have to make sense. I mean,
the snake can eat its tail. You know, it's fine.
Everyone from the czarist secret police to the Nazis said, you know, world communism was a conspiracy of Jewish bankers.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, doesn't have to make sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I think, you know, it's important. I mean, somebody had pointed out the New York Times edit bot or whatever that follows the changes in online articles in the New York Times, right, and posts some, had posted a very funny one where, again, posting an article, a news article this time about the campus protests. They had initially mentioned that the protests at Columbia had like a large participation of Jewish students in the protests, and then edited it out of the article to exclude any comments that there were Jews at the protests protesting to free Palestine. And we've said this on a show a lot, and, you know, and I don't want to like, I don't mean this in any way to like denigrate Palestinian participation or Arab or Muslim participation in these events, of which there is plenty. But those have always been such marginalized groups in America that most, when you talk about like average normie Americans who get become aware of the Israel-Palestine issue, most of that awareness is coming from American Jews, right? Yeah. Like every bit of commentary that informed me about this issue came from American Jewish academics and American Jews who had gone on Birthright and basically been like, you don't understand, that place is fucked. And then once you get past like a certain level of awareness, right, where you have like a certain grounding in the, what's happening, then you start to become like aware of Palestinian scholars, or you, you know, come into contact then with like, usually through, again, American Jews, you come into contact with like Palestinians who then give you that side of the story as well, right? Which is equally, if not more horrific. And so it's one of those things of what makes the cries of anti-Semitism, I mean, this ginned up panic, it's what makes it so maddening from the perspective of people on the left, I guess, right? Like, you know, it's obviously, I think it's obviously working on some level. We'll talk about that here in a minute.
Yeah.
Before we get there, though, what I wanted to talk about, and me and you talked about this a little bit yesterday off mic, but when these crackdowns started happening all across the country on these campuses where there's just these huge police, you know, like SWAT crackdowns, I mean, stuff that was like pretty fucking wild. I mean, there must have been 200 cops at the University of Texas, right, cracking down at UT. There must have been at least 200 cops at New York, at Columbia, raiding Columbia. I mean, it was like just these massive.
It's more than that. I've seen people say that like the Columbia and CUNY crackdowns, like the NYPD mobilizations, like rival the biggest during 2020.
Yeah.
BLM protests, which is wild to even think about. Like,
yeah, they're
like way out of scale.
Yeah.
Compared to the number of like kids on a college campus. Like,
yeah, because it should be noted. I mean, like, there was obviously these massive crackdowns in 2020. The 2020 protests were also bigger.
Oh, way you know? Bigger.
Like, I mean, like,
astronomically bigger.
Amount,
the biggest ones. And then even like the daily ones, like, these aren't huge crowds on these campuses because they're campus protests, because it's largely students. So it's a relatively small pool of students and faculty you're pulling from. And so, yeah, they're not like these aren't like the BLM protests in size.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cause certainly not the gigantic fucking marches, you know?
Yeah. Cause the BLM protests, I mean, really were all these people that you're seeing at these campus protests were essentially at the BLM protests. I mean, there's significant crossover, right?
Plus people from all walks of life.
Plus like people outside the college community and stuff like that. Right. And so they were just these mass events, and, you know, to see, you know, I mean, this is a situation where I think in a lot of these crackdowns, there was almost like a 1-to-1 police officer to protester ratio. I mean, which is pretty unheard of.
Fund the police.
Yeah, exactly. You could thank Biden for that. But seeing this crackdown, it reminded me, or at least the thing that came to my mind immediately, which maybe is a memory hold for a lot of people, but back during the Occupy movement ended in a single 2-day period, right?
Yeah.
And it ended because Obama had basically said in a speech publicly that, like, we've tolerated this long enough, it's time for this to end. And then all of a sudden, there was this coordinated mass arrest or sweep of all the encampments all over the country. And it came out, I think, literally the day of the arrests, that Obama had been on the phone with governors from all over the country talking about the protests, right, the day before. And it's like, I wonder what they were talking about, right? Like, obviously, Obama had coordinated the crackdown on Occupy out of the White House, right?
Yeah.
And look, we don't have that same smoking gun that we got from, you know, the crackdown on Occupy, but I don't think it's unreasonable, and Greg, you can let me know what you think about this, that Biden's doing the same. You know, now, is Joe doing it personally? You know, That's up to request. But the White House is coordinating this.
Yeah, I think that, you know, if that sounds conspiratorial to you, I don't know what to tell you. That is how government works. Like, the crackdowns seem crazy and really out of proportion and a stupid and wrong thing to do to a lot of people. And, you know, we can talk about that, but they do take, it is like a decision someone had to make, and, you know, they're getting pressure from a lot of places. The university presidents are getting pressure from donors, I think is a huge part of it. They're getting pressure from the cities they're in, from the states, these encampments were up and around for like 2 weeks, you know, and there's been protests for months now. This massive crackdown to all basically come at the same time, particularly after like the first one at Columbia looked so like immediately looked like a wild overreaction for then it to have the apparent effect of actually giving other administrators around the country like permission, actually encourage, because that's the other possible narrative is like, well, they pulled the trigger at Columbia and the NYPD like came in and really went wild. You know, so now we should start doing it everywhere else. That's that's one possible, like that then this all just happened very quickly. I know. I think the obvious answer here is no, this was a federally coordinated thing out of the White House. The Biden's part in it, whether he, I mean, you know,
this is just like what level of cognizance do you
what
think
level
Biden's
of finesse he I mean look
point,
I'm sure he was know? In on these calls. I'm sure he was talking to the governors. Like, he doesn't have to have the same like level of like you know, administrative detail as Obama, but like his big part in it was after needing to come out and reassure like everybody, no, this was the right thing. No, you think this looks like an overreaction? Like, this is wrong? No, this is me, the president of the United States, coming out and saying, nope, this had to happen and it needs to continue happening if you haven't done it on your campus yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this, I'm giving you now that cover. If some of you have wavered and you're like, we're running on those calls. I don't know, man, this looks like a bunch of assholes here. He comes out and gives you the cover, like, publicly, you know?
Yeah, and he had actually... So
that speech is fucking insane.
Yeah, he gave that formal speech endorsing the crackdown.
Rolling back the basic right to...
to protest. Yeah.
I mean, look, that was obviously gone. We knew that. I mean, like, to the extent it ever existed in the country, which of course it didn't. But rolling back it as part of a Democratic Party platform or narrative, or like something you can say with a straight face as a Democrat that, like, or a liberal in this country that you believe in, or that there is like an institutional force in America, like the Democratic Party, that actually believes in the right to protest, you know, peaceably, you know, and he had to come out. He had to come out and say, no, we're drawing a different line, even than the bullshit, you know, we sell, right? Which is that, the protests were cracked down on mercilessly in the 60s against the war, but we learned from that and we're different. And we're actually the, you know, we're the post Watergate generation, like, you know, running the country now. And so that's not how we do. Just like at Columbia, they're like, you know, they have like holidays celebrating the like takeover with shotguns of campus buildings by students, you know? And you know, he made it very clear, I think, like, this is the president of the United States saying, calling these protests violent, which is, you know, depending on your perspective, either just a bald lie or a redefinition, which one that's been used by the police, by local governments, where you say, you know, where people are protesting peacefully, not hurting anybody, but either, you know, then the cops come in and start a riot and then they come out and say, oh, well, this was violence. Interestingly, the news coverage of this was such, and like, I don't think they're even trying to sell that line, like, talk about, because I th- weirdly, I think, unlike in the BLM protests, like, that's an interesting thing right there. Like, no one's saying, I haven't seen, even on Fox, like, I've seen Fox clips where they're not going, like, look at this violence of the protesters fighting with the cops. And, like, everyone understands, like, that that won't sell, evidently, for whatever reason. Maybe the degree to which people were already paying attention, maybe it's that the cops didn't come in soon enough because it was like a such a peaceful campus protest, and because it's built for so long and they didn't right away when the first protest happened 6 months ago. I don't know. Where, like, because if you get there right away and start hassling people, or you never let the protest fully develop, right, then it's like a thing that happened. It's like clashes between protesters and police, right? Maybe it's because this was all established, and even in right-wing media, they were talking about how these people need to get swept away for days for Stan, you know, and like seeing all the whining Hasbara jerks like piss their pants because, like, you know, students and kafias are like doing hacky sack on the quad, you know, and then staying overnight in a sleepover. Maybe because that was all established so with such saturation over the over months, really, and then over 2 weeks, that you couldn't do the, oh, look at the violent protesters who had to be beat up by the cops. That, you know, maybe you couldn't do that. So they're doing, and it's so clear that there was not what I would call violence happening, and then the cops came in. But what the other thing he's then doing in that is another thing that police and, you know, local governments have done, and lots of commentators is, you know, is call things that aren't violence, violence, which is, you know, to se- to remove any separation between harming other human beings and property damage. And like token property damage, like fucking spray paint, which, you know, you can clean off literally any surface, and some broken windows or some chairs piled up against a door, for which, again, is a that one is getting closer to the other tactic of saying, calling the riot the police start the violence, you know, because it is in a response to the police coming and trying to kick them off the quad, and so they had to, they decided they had to barricade themselves. So that's a response to the violence workers showing up. But mostly they're, you know, he's out there saying, like, well, yeah, protest is okay, but it can't turn, you know, violent and nasty. And it's like, well, you know, well, I guess what you're saying is you're calling the graffiti and the broken windows and the okay, in the case of Columbia, the occupation of a building by students of the college at the building, like, you're calling that violence. And it's like, you know, that's that, so that's a change in that's a, you know, it's one thing to hear that from like Brandy Cruz and shit, right? But this is the president of the Democratic president of the United States really defining how the even a Democratic administration is going to think about protest against the state in this country. And now we're at this a new point again where you have to ask, how the fuck are you asking me to get out and vote for Joe Biden when the thing that is supposed to be different here is, it's not the genocide, because we've decided that, well, yeah, nope, that's just happening.
That's just going to happen.
That's outside of the scope of American politics. Like, obviously, we're going to back Israel to the hilt in their horrifying murder, mass murder of children, starvation of 2 million people. But the tone, the manners are different, at least here in America, right? Between Trump, who will just trample your rights with, you know, fascism, and Biden, who...
As people continually have pointed out, you know, it's a great argument that we have to vote for Biden to make sure that Trump doesn't do all the things that Biden's currently doing, right? And, you know, this is the circular argument that Democrat diehards have been bending themselves into a pretzel trying to make. But on this question of violence, I mean, there's like, there's some interesting things in there. I mean, one of the arguments that's come out, which always comes out during these protests, it came out during BLM too, is this comparison to an imagined nonviolent 60s, right? You know, where the civil rights movement was just totally passive, which is, of course, just all bullshit, right? And you can just throw that out, you know, whatever. But I think some professors in particular, and some of the students at these places, have pointed out how kind of out of proportion the police response has been, even compared to the 60s. And what they meant by that wasn't that, like, oh, the police didn't come crackheads in the 60s or anything like that. But as you were saying, they were like, yeah, and some of those events, though, like, it was a slightly different context where, like, students in the 60s were calling for, like, the revolution. I mean, by the time we're talking the late 60s, when, like, the Workers' Student Alliance is in control of SDS, they're calling for the revolutionary overthrow of the United States. They're carrying guns.
And in the, and in the 70s, they're bombing buildings campuses. Yeah. People are actually bombing campuses and occasionally actually killing people who work for the college, you know.
And whether you think that, like, that was, you know, good or bad or whatever you think about that in the 60s, that is a qualitatively different scenario than basically calling in half of NYPD to, crack the heads of Columbia students for having a sleepover on their own campus, and professors, for having sleepovers on their own campus. And that's, you know, I think that's a qualitative difference that has to be acknowledged.
On the legal. And another thing that Biden said was, you know, violence was one reason that justified this, but also trespassing.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, what protest isn't trespassing? The one you do in your own living room?
Yeah.
First of all, so that, you know, this rules out anything, this rules out peaceable assembly in America, right?
Yeah.
Because what are we talking about? Like, okay, so so maybe you can't trespass in a public street, but you can fucking jaywalk. So, like, what's next, right? Like, But you're talking about, this is the legal facade that the campuses used, that the administration used to, they just declared their students trespassing.
Yeah.
They just, their own students and faculty,
they said.
What makes
it trespassing? The president just said it one day. So one day they were a student who was on campus legally, and then the president just said, well, now they're trespassing. Not to the students, they said it to the police. So at any time, you're subject to arrest.
I mean, to be fair, I think they said it to the students first. But what they did was, they did whatever administrative procedure to suspend or, you know, they disinvited them from campus. And then suddenly now they're legally trespassing, which, you know, when you have, look, there are reasons, like laws like that and policies like that exist, that, you know, you could, you know, get in some kind of a goofball like argument about, well, like, you know, you have to be able to call the police to take away some, like, weird, you know, violent asshole who's causing problems on your campus or something. We're talking about protest here. Yeah. We're talking about this being used to quell a peaceful, I'm going to say it, peaceful protest, you know, like.
Well, and the reason why they were saying stuff like trespassing, usually, so if you have somebody who comes on campus who is, say, attacking a student or something like that, or doing something crazy, you know, you would call the police, and trespassing might certainly be one of the charges.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? But the reason you called the police was
there's something
the assaults, the whatever, right? And, like, in this case, because the students were being extremely disciplined and, you know, to their credit, right? I think this is the result of having been participants in BLM, right?
Yeah.
We're being extremely disciplined. This is all the president could do. The university presidents could do is just go, trespassing, you know? And then that's why they kept making up shit. I mean, I think it was at Northeastern, which is in Boston. At Northeastern, the college president, when she called in the police, the official public statement they made was, oh, I called in the police because it's no longer a peaceful protest because people are chanting kill all Jews. Now, when people pointed out, and something that could not have been, that the president could not have been unaware of, because it was, you know, that president knew about this from videos posted online where this was pointed out, the people chanting kill all Jews were the Zionist protesters there. So the Zionist protesters were outside the encampment chanting kill all Jews at the encampment.
Well, it worked.
And yeah, as the Daily Beast had a hilarious, you know, headline on that, which was like, you know, protester chants kill all Jews, gets everyone else arrested. And so anyways, this was pointed out by professors at Northeastern to the president, who then replied again in a formal message saying, well, nonetheless.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and I think it shows the emptiness. This is why, like, liberal arguments about natural rights are always stupid. And I'm not here going to try and make one. Because the real answer is, like, your rights are always can be taken away at a whim in a society that's extremely unequal and has very unequal power relationships, you know? Right? Now, the other thing I wanted to get to about violence is this point that you were making earlier, which is Biden's sort of redefinition of it. And I think a way that we actually do have to recognize and acknowledge, which was shown in the initial raid of Columbia when NYPD responded saying, well, it looked like a peaceful protest to us. And now there was a college in Philadelphia that called the police on their own students. And the Philadelphia police basically said that they didn't know if they could do it because it was just a peaceful protest and they didn't know they could crack down on it. There was a liberal arts college, I think, in Colorado, same story, where the police basically like balked at it because they're like, well,
it looks legal to me, is what the chief said, you know?
Yeah, and that seems like a legal quagmire, which means that it's not just that Biden's redefined violence. He's redefined it to the right of America's police departments, right? Like the fascists who think that it's totally okay to like murder a child if they look at you wrong have basically thinking I don't know that that's actually an actionable offense, you know?
Yeah, this is
pretty crazy.
This is very interesting to me. Yeah. Like the police refusing because like and not buying like whatever like the technical like bullshit, just seeing the police looking at this where these administrators are looking at this, and I'm going to say, yeah, hearing from the Biden White House, like, okay, this is what we're supposed to do. This is what we're being told we need to do by our donors, by the state, by the White House. And the cops are not getting that message.
Yeah.
And what that means, I mean, that's very weird to me. Like, that's very surprising.
Well, I think it means that part of it is I think it does mean that Biden staked out a legal position that's to the right of a lot of police departments. I think they do actually think about that stuff sometimes. There was the thing here in King County where they ordered them to like go essentially enforce sit lie laws. And the county sheriff's department was like, yeah, we're not going to do that just because like this is in court currently. And like we're not going to get ourselves like tangled up in this fucking bullshit where we're going to be in court for the next 5 years on this. Like, so we're going to wait until we hear what the court says.
That's, that's a sheriff with no imagination. That sounds like a lot of OT to me.
Yeah, right.
That's why I'm confused. You know,
well,
this
is the difference between a sheriff's department and a police department. The sheriff's department is specifically like an elected, extremely lazy official.
Yeah, you're saying that's
they're
a good
purely
thing to be
for the corruption. Just they're purely for the corruption.
Well,
like, sounds like a lot of paperwork to me.
I mean, I noticed this from the beginning. Like the police, from the minute the protest started, you know, having come off the experience of 2020, right? The minute the protest started in this country for Palestine, I was interested in the fact that police departments really didn't want much to do with it, you know? Because, you know, you can imagine another scenario where they are, because they're politicized to the right, because they like cracking heads, because they like order, because this is what they like to do, that they would, you know, find ways to flex their muscle on these. And, you know, all the actions I have been to in Seattle, you know, which, you know, does not include like the freeway ones. I was not at those. You know, there are things that happened that caused police responses eventually that rose to the level that the police felt they should get involved. And the freeway stuff was one of those. But, you know, for the most part, the actions I went to, the marches, there were cops around, like a few in kind of as small a number as possible on an opposite street corner. Like, four, you know, you'd have a group of four standing over here. Maybe you'd have a group of four standing on the opposite end of whatever was going on. Kind of just looking at their phones, just like doing nothing. And that's interesting. And it says a few things. It says to me, like, how much... And this is something we always, you know, talked about in 2020, like what percentage was the police response to 2020 and the level of insanity of it and the degree to which they absolutely lost their mind across the country and God knows in Seattle was because it was a protest against them.
Yeah.
That reinforced to me that was a high percentage of the reason for the way they reacted was because they were the targets of the protest.
Yeah. And I think you know, to that point too, I think the police have traditionally seen college campuses as not necessarily outside their jurisdiction, but kind of not their problem.
Yeah.
Right. Like they'll go there if, you know, asked politely or whatever. Right. But like they kind of consider it like there's always been an agreement between, especially in college towns, like local police and the college about like, hey, we're going to kind of like let things go or over here. Right.
So much so that at big universities and cities,
mm-hmm.
they have their own police departments.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because of the development of the feeling that like the regular city PD like
is the wrong tool.
It's doesn't work. You know, they don't want to do it. You don't want them to do it. You need something else because, you know, because the cops are basically because they're there to police poor people, to do things that college kids, at the elite regeneration reproduction factories of America are doing all the time.
Mm.
But they're not poor, like shiftless layabouts who need to be over-policed. They're doing drugs and doing wacky shit in the streets and even maybe doing some graffiti. Maybe they're, you know, swinging from lampposts at night. Maybe they're setting cars on fire and having like ragers and underage drinking and like things that would cause noise complaints, everything in between. But they're allowed to do that, you know?
I remember at Texas Tech, a campus police officer, this is during orientation, telling us a story kind of jokingly and laughing about how after a football game, he was in a squad car. And of course, he's like, you know, there's like 50,000 people this game. So it's like this huge mass of people moving around. That a kid had stopped and started to pee on the like wheel of his car, like the tire of his car, and how he flipped his lights on and stuck his head out basically and was like, are you driving home? And the kid said, no, I'm just going to my dorm. And he's like, I think you should get out of here. And the kid left. Right.
Yeah.
And like, that's the difference between campus PD and like the regular police department. And the regular police department, that's obviously a very different situation. And the thing is, it's like, the people at the BLM protest looked a lot more like the targets that cops shoot at the firing range, right? Than the people on these campus things. So I think that is like part of this thing that you're getting at, right? Of like at the initial outlay of these events on campus, like what the police response would be, you know, I think that's where the question mark was. And obviously like, you know, NYPD was told, I think Columbia is a very different story than some of these other small colleges, right? This is a fucking major university in the American city, right?
Yeah. Like,
so I think they were told, we know now that Adams has been on top of them about this too, right? The mayor, that like, no, like whatever you think about this, you're cracking down. Like, you know, you need to go in and do it. Which I think gets to a question that we should talk about here in a second about like why this big crackdown.
Well, that is a big question to talk about. And, since we have a lot more to say on it, you want to take it to the Patreon?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, folks, meet us behind the wall.